In case you think we're starting late, it's actually not that late. That clock is wrong. It's too fast, which is not good for a bina clock. So we're doing a once-off today. It was actually supposed to be a two-week series about moral and ethical dilemmas. But we pushed it off because we did that special week after the bridge incident. So we're going to just do a once-off today. And then next week, we're starting a three-week series leading up to Rosh Hashanah, focused on personal growth, but learning new lessons or different ways to learn new, same old lessons from the various symbols that we use throughout the festivals, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and so on. So that's from next week. Spread it around. It'll be an exciting preparation. In addition to the lots of things happening, I'm sure you've seen, if you notice the notice board, it's very busy. If you notice the WhatsApps, they're also very busy. I hope you're listening to them, by the way. We can tell. No, I actually can't tell. Actually can't tell because it's on a broadcast. We send them out. So I'm just trusting you. But there's going to be lots more in the next few weeks because it is a busy time of the year. It's a special time of the year. It's the most special time of the year, as you know. Elul leading up to Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and etc. Just to mention one or two things. So this coming Wednesday night is a home shiur at the home of Mandy and Oren Glick called Developing Healthy Habits. It's a general topic, but of course relevant to this time of the year. This is the time that we try to develop new good habits, I suppose. It's 7:30 for a 7:45 start. I guess what that means is if you want to socialize a bit, come at 7:30. If you want to only come to the shiur, come at 7:45. Also, if I can just mention something, we're having a very special event for young adults. We're having a whole bunch of things for young adults next few weeks, but on the 16th of June, I'm going to leave out some flyers afterwards. We're having something called New Year, New Light.
Why you said June?
Oh, sorry. No, it's a bit...
June.
Thanks. Yeah, I just want to test people listening. That's what. September, sorry. 16th. Gosh.
16th of September.
It is September, right? Coming up, yeah?
Yeah.
16th of September. Sorry, it's real busy. It's real busy these days. I'm a bit all over the place. It'll be a very nice... We've had similar events before, but this will be next door at Mizrahi Hall. There'll be nice socializing with beautiful food and drink and so on. And followed by an inspirational sort of journey with music and inspiration and so on, which will be done by... The music will be done by Ezri Israel and his brother Mizzi. And the inspiration will be done myself and Rabbi Levi. And be beautiful. People need to book for it, so... There's a QR code on the actual flyer. So please take a spread around. If you know any relatives, friends, and so on, encourage them to come. It'll be a beautiful way to prepare for the new year. It's a week before Rosh Hashanah, which is also September, by the way. So Tuesday, which one? Next week, that's the Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Yeah. Wednesday, I'm going to check the date this time. 3rd of September. Yeah. No, it's, yeah, that's it, yeah. And so there's lots on. You might have noticed on the flyers, we've called this year's journey, we've called this year's preparation for the new year and the activities during the festival period. We've called it Od Yer Ter Tov. You know that song that everyone sings, that Od Yer Ter Tov? Which means it's all good, but we need it to be even better. And therefore, we're going to make ourselves better. And of course, God is going to bless us with an amazing new year. Praise God. Just before we jump into the shiur, one more thing I just wanted to mention is you might have noticed we're also running a different campaign at the same time, all connected, of course, to Bina. We're running for the next, started yesterday, for the next 18 days, a giving campaign where... You know, Bina, thank God, over the last few years has been impacting and reaching many, many more people. We're not a shul in that sense. We don't have membership. We rely on donations and those people who are monthly donors, monthly builders, as we call them. So we need to boost that and boost our support in general, so in order to keep going and to expand, please God. So we're asking people who haven't yet become donors or monthly donors, especially an emphasis on the monthly giving. We're calling people and asking them to do whatever they can, but to give monthly, and you'll probably get a call, or you can do it online, or you can talk to me. But spread the campaign, and if you're not yet a monthly donor or a big donor or whatever, please join in. Elul is, besides being a good time to learn, Elul is also a good time to give tzedakah, so you can be covered by that as well. And it's really important that we do boost the support. There's more stuff going on, there's more expenses, there's a need to really boost and hopefully to expand. Okay, so let's jump into what we're doing today. So what I wanted to share with you today, again, as a once-off, I want to share just two dilemmas. One is a bit more practical and one is sort of more philosophical, but it's a very interesting, hopefully interesting discussion. So the first one is actually a real story, I mean a real question that someone came to me with a few weeks ago. I know someone that works in the government space, legal aid. And he had a client. And he was assigned a client, I should say. And the client was an alcoholic, a woman who was quite a significant alcoholic, who became pregnant. Heavy drinker. And it was very, very clear that if she continues that way through the pregnancy, she will damage, or besides damaging herself, but she'll damage the baby, for sure. Permanent damage, right? Because when we talk about alcoholism, we're talking about heavy drinking, a lot of drinking. You know, someone's pregnant and they have a sip of Kiddush wine on a Friday night. I don't think anything's going to happen to the baby. But in fact, I know nothing will happen to the baby. I've seen it happen. Proper drinking will definitely damage the baby. I mean, there's a lot of research on it now. There's things they call FAS, which is fetal alcohol syndrome. All sorts of different things can happen. Growth restrictions, abnormalities, organ damage, learning difficulties, IQ, all sorts of things, right? Miscarriages sometimes, stillbirth, God forbid. All sorts of things, right? So the authorities spoke to her, department of whatever spoke to her, and explained to her that she really, if she wants to go through this, really needs to dry up, essentially. And her response was, she knows, she's read about it, she understands, and she just can't. She's not going to do it, it's not going to happen. She can't go off that addiction. And the legal question that came up, or maybe the suggestion came up from the authorities, was to actually forcibly restrain her. Now, I asked, what does that mean? It doesn't mean put her in chains. It means to forcibly put her into a clinic with security, with protection that she won't leave. Against her will, essentially. She would need to be there throughout the entire pregnancy and hopefully give birth to a healthy child. So he came to me, obviously, he wasn't asking me a halachic practical advice, because the last time I checked, the government doesn't seek halachic advice. But he was interested, being a member of the community, he was very interested to understand what the Jewish view is on that. So I said, it's a really interesting question. I never heard that question before. What do you think? Sorry?
I don't think you can do this.
You don't think, why?
Because I think it's taking away someone's rights. And if they're not mentally, you know, it's not like you put someone in a straitjacket and you say, you know, you're being taken to hospital and you know, you can't be responsible to yourself. It's a very hard question.
It is a hard question. I know. It's a very hard question. Sorry? I guess she didn't want. I mean, that would be a separate question, halachically, but okay.
After 3 months, that's probably out of the question anyway.
Correct.
It probably came up a bit later anyway.
I'm not sure. No, I think. Oh, I don't know. Okay, well, that's a different question, because maybe the question then will become when she gives birth to the child, maybe the child needs to be removed. That's true. Which is a separate question, but that's sometimes...
You can't remove
the pregnant. No, correct. That, I'm saying, so...
Everything you teach us is about free choice. So she has the power to choose to get helped or to not.
Correct.
Sorry,
what was that?
What about the right of the child?
That's right.
So...
I could choose to dry out, but that is very selfish for the child.
Right, so you're saying maybe you should be restrained then, if that's the case, right?
No, I think she should.
No, I don't think
I
can.
Okay, that's one response. Can you force someone to have an abortion? Putting aside the Jewish view on abortion, can you force someone? I'm not sure you could. And also, maybe that's going against the rights of the child. Right, one of the arguments against abortion is you haven't consulted the child, except certain circumstances, right? I mean, we'll talk a little bit about that because it is relevant. But so it's yeah, I mean, what I'm getting, and I thought that would happen is, because I had the same thought in my mind right away, before I thought about it or tried to research a bit, it's actually hard to find sources that address this exact question, but there was a visiting rabbi at the time, someone who heads the yeshiva, and I was talking to him about it. But it's a very difficult question. It's a very, very difficult question.
The question also arises when you've got someone who's got HIV, you've got someone who's addicted to cocaine.
Correct, correct.
There's a lot of people correct. Out there that have children. Drug addicts.
Well, drug addicts should be exactly the same thing, of course. It'd be the same question.
Are you going to be able to police all those people?
Good question.
But I think the rights of the child are more important than the rights of the mother under the circumstances.
I'm not talking about rights.
Can you restrain? Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Okay. There's different views in the room, and I get that. And that's why it's such a complex question. Right.
In no way did the mother, like, it's an opportunity to change that. She said, no way, I'm not going
no
to
way, change. No way, no. I mean, that was, of course, the first option. I mean, you would hope that you sit down with the person and say, listen, you...
I actually know someone who had a drug addiction, got pregnant, and that was the beginning of her cleaning herself up totally.
You would hope. That would be, yeah. But this was a thing where, I'm not ever going to try. That was her response. Obviously, it's a disturbed person. Obviously, it's a problem that the person's not making poor choices, but that's obviously what should happen, right? Because obviously, better than forcing, even in case where you could force someone to do something, obviously better than forcing is to inspire, right? But so you'd want to inspire someone to make that choice and to try and change, and at least to minimize or to do something that would make it safer at least, whatever the case is. Okay, so let's break it down a little bit. What I'm going to do is I'm not, as I say in Yiddish, I'm not paskening, which means I'm not going to, it's not my area of expertise, it's above my pay grade to actually issue. I would never, even if it was a real practical question, I was consulted, I would never issue a ruling anyway, because you need someone a lot greater than that. But it's just an interesting springboard for some interesting discussions. Now, an unrelated but related topic, which will also be related to the second thing we're going to say, the second topic we can discuss, which is totally different. When we say restrain, I just want to talk about this for a second, right? I mean, you do restrain people who are criminals, for example, but you should just know that Jewish view in general, not in this case necessarily, but the Jewish view on prison, right? That's not really related, but it is just worth mentioning for a few minutes. The Torah is, if you look in the pure sense of justice, the way the Torah approaches it, talking about application of justice in the time when Jews were sovereign in the land of Israel in biblical times, where they ran the law based on Torah law, right, which is different to the modern state of Israel. The Torah is actually not in favor of imprisonment, generally speaking. Not in favor of prison. Probably other punishments, but not in favor of prison. Because it doesn't work. Probably that's the main reason. And in fact, it strengthens the argument I've said, you talked about taking away people's rights. Because when you put a person in prison, the only way to keep them there nowadays is, I mean, the way prison is run nowadays anyways, I mean, they call it a correctional center. It's a fib, because it's not a correctional center. Just so you know that I looked it up, and I asked my friend GPT to tell me. the rate of recidivism in New South Wales alone, do you know what it is? In New South Wales, it's actually 48.8%, which is huge. And in juveniles, it's over 50%. So it's not working. Okay. Now, there are two times where the Torah is very clear that prison is an option, right? The first one is a type of prison, but it's not really a prison. It's actually a very different system. So there was a concept in the Torah where someone has to lose some of their freedom when they, the modern term would be manslaughter. What's called in the Torah is unintentional killing. But there's, the Talmud talks about different forms of murder, so obviously there's real murder. In the Torah, murder carries a capital punishment, under certain circumstances, if there's proper evidence and so on. But, right, if someone killed completely out of his control, had nothing to do with it, wouldn't be able to prevent it anyway, then there's no punishment. But if someone killed in a way where it was unintentional, but there was some level of negligence, it's called in Torah, Horeg Bishkaga. Right, you kill by mistake, in which case the punishment is exile. And there were 42 cities in Israel that were designated for such things. There were actually primarily six, talked about in this week's parsha actually, and then also another 42, which was a place they had to go, they had to remain there for a certain period of time. But here's the fascinating thing, those cities were regular cities. You lived there normally, but you were restricted, you couldn't go anywhere, so you lost your freedom. And it was the same cities that were given to the Levites. Now the tribe of Levi, one of the 12 tribes, from where the Kohanim and the Levim come, they were not given a portion of the land of Israel. When the Jews entered Israel, the land was divided up, each tribe received a portion. Basically it was an agricultural society, right? The tribe of Levi were not given a portion of the land because their mission was to serve God and to teach Torah and to travel the land. So where did they live? They lived in these designated 42 cities, kind of like a housing commission sort of system in a way, right? And that's where they lived. But the Levim typically were teachers and they were inspiring people and they were tzaddikim, right? In those times. And they were so not high, I'm not the word higher, they were holy, I guess, right? Than common folk. And they lived in the cities and those were the cities where these murderers came. Manslaughter people came. Why? Because that was true. It was true rehabilitation, right? The atonement they had to achieve, and the inspiration they had to get to be more careful in the future, came from hanging around during that time, near with and interacting with the Levim. So when there's only one instance where the Torah actually gives a punishment, so to speak, of a kind of prison, but it's a completely different system. It's a rehabilitative prison sentence. The other time that the Torah does advocate prison or restraining is, and this is where the relevance comes into our discussion, is preventing damage to others. So for example, if someone circumstantially was guilty of murder, and it's pretty clear, but yet could not be convicted with a capital punishment because of the technical evidence structure, the way the Torah mandates it, but they were a murderer and they were a violent person, or anyone that proves to be a very violent person has to be restrained, they are put in jail. Not for punishment, for prevention to others. Right? Other than that, there are other punishments in the Torah, financial things, sometimes even lashes, sometimes capital punishment, but not prison. Okay. But the one exception to prison is, besides the cities of refuge, where the murderer, where the manslaughter would go, it was to prevent damage to others. Now, there's a number of questions here. First of all, true, we always talk about free choice, but can you force someone to do the right thing? So I want to clarify, right? I mean, nowadays we normally take the view that you don't force people to do the right thing, even though it's not so simple actually, right? In old biblical times, there was times where they did force people to do the right thing, generally speaking. That's not a really contradiction to free choice. That's just saying you shouldn't have to wait for that. A person has the capacity of free choice. You get to choose between right and wrong. It doesn't mean you're free to choose right and wrong. We're not supposed to choose wrong over right. We have the ability to choose right over wrong, right? Which gives us responsibility more than anything else. It doesn't mean God says, listen, I have a bunch of laws, I have a bunch of values. You choose. I don't mind if you don't keep them. I don't mind if you do keep them. It's not quite the way it works. I want you to keep them. In fact, the Torah says, I'm giving you today good and bad, life and death, ubacharta b'chaim, I want you to choose life. Now, can you inspire other people? Could you try to get other people to choose life? Of course. Can you force them? Question. First of all, it's got to work, right? It's got to work. Now, so I would say, normally today, we don't force people, we don't restrain people, you know. Say, if you don't put a mezuzah on your door, I'm going to put you in jail. We don't do that, right? It's something, because it doesn't work. People have to come, you know. It's called Kfiyat Atit in Hebrew. Right? There's even a huge controversy in the land of Israel whether they have the right to enforce certain religious practices. You know, I'm not going to get into that because it's very political. But like in Israel, there's a thing in the hospital, you know, that are bringing chametz on Pesach. Right? It's a huge thing because some people say, what do you mean? It's a right of everyone. Okay, separate discussion. But generally, we don't force people, and it's not a good idea to force people anyway. But it's not so simple. First of all, we do have a responsibility to other people. There are leadership responsibilities to make sure people do the right thing. But the specific area I want to focus on is doing the right thing, especially when they're going to harm other people. Because there we see it does change, right? We will definitely restrain someone from helping, even halachically. Even an individual is allowed to do that. If you see someone on the way, clearly that he's about to murder someone else, it's called a rodef, you may take a gun and, let's say, shoot the person's foot so he can't get there. If you don't have any other way to do it, right? In extreme circumstances, in fact, you are commanded to, don't try this at home, because, but in certain circumstances, according to the Talmud, if there's no way to prevent A killing B other than killing A, you're supposed to kill A. Even an individual, right? Self-defense for sure is okay, right? So when someone is doing something that's clearly going to hurt other people, you can force them to do the right thing. You can prevent them. Now, let's go back to our scenario. The first thing we need to understand, who is she hurting? Herself or someone else? Well, she's clearly hurting herself, but the question is she hurting someone else as well? Yeah. Well, it's an interesting discussion because, again, I said I'm more highlighting issues than actually coming to conclusions, right? Why? Because over here you do need to a little bit go into the definition of a fetus, right? Which, of course, goes into the halachic discussion of abortion, which is interesting. It's a very, very, very complex topic in Jewish law. I will mention, I've mentioned this before, that in today, particularly in America, the nation is very divided between what they call pro-life and pro-choice, and Judaism belongs to neither group. Why do I say that? Yeah, I mean, everyone always understands that Judaism is not pro-abortion, that's true. But first of all, the pro-lifers, the people who are pro-life, maintain that it's a complete life, right? The baby's a complete life. You never have a reason to take that life under any circumstances. There are Catholics, for example, that believe that. And whether the mother will be in danger, whether the mother will have a complete nervous mental crisis as a result, doesn't matter what the circumstances are, you know that pro-life means you can't take the life of a baby as soon as the heart begins to beat, or even before maybe, from conception, it's a life and you can't take it. It's like taking another human being in the street. Jewish law does not subscribe to that, right? A fetus actually in Talmud is not exactly the same as another human being. It is a life, but it's not exactly the same as another human being. Now, what it is very complex because there are different parts of the Talmud that actually imply different things. That's a very, very complex discussion, resulting in even down to modern day expert halachic, poskim, how you say, legislators or people that rule on modern day halacha, like Rav Moshe Feinstein or Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, these very, very great people, right? They actually differ. None of them differ in terms of the fundamentals. We don't say abortion is permitted. We just don't do that, right? But how severe it is and under which the extent of exceptions, put it that way, the extent of exceptions differ. Because according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, who writes a whole thesis, many theses on it, and he draws different conclusions from the Talmud and his commentaries, according to him, it's almost like a life, and abortion is almost like murder. Not exactly the same. It wouldn't carry the same punishment, right? However, there are other places where other halachic authorities that hold that, it's not really murder because we have, the Gemara tells us that ubar yerech imo, the fetus is part of the mother, it's an extension of the mother. Until the fetus is born, it's actually an extension of the mother. And therefore, they're a bit more lenient in terms of like if the mother's in danger or the mother will suffer a nervous breakdown or, I mean, obviously these things need to be, you know, properly decided, properly thoroughly looked at. But therefore, there are more instances where abortion would be permitted, in fact, going to them. That's why it's not pro-life. I'm saying it's not under any circumstance. Because it's not exactly the same as another human being. It's very important and we treat it very strictly and severely and very carefully, but it's not exactly the same as the pro-life movement. Conversely, we definitely are part of the pro-choice movement for the following reason. Because even if you say a fetus is part of the mother's body, and therefore it's, what do they say, my body, my choice, that's actually not a Jewish idea. Our bodies do not belong to us. Right? Living with the values of Torah, our bodies don't belong to us. They are on loan from God to do what we need to do in this universe. Right? Now, there's lots of halachot. I'm not just saying this as a philosophical nice idea. There are lots of Jewish laws that are an extension of that principle. For example, you don't get to choose whether you harm yourself. Halachically, one is not permitted to injure themselves. Right? It's a very fascinating area of Jewish law because it's even comes in now. Operation obviously different because you're doing it for the health of the person, right? Where there is, and there's plenty of loopholes and plenty of reasons why it could be done, but I just want to highlight and give you an example of where this is applied in Jewish law. It's very fascinating. It's cosmetic surgery for cosmetic reasons only, right? It's not that simple that it's permitted in Jewish law because you're harming yourself. For why? Because you want to look nice? Okay. Is that a reason? Maybe there is reasons because they're even very, very early sources in Jewish law, way before the awareness of mental health took place, they talk about the emotional state of a human being, and that's sometimes a factor that's just equal to health and so on and so forth. But it is a question. The reason it's a question is because you don't just get to do with your body what you want, right? So first of all, it is a life. It is some sort of life. But second of all, even if it isn't, and even if it's just an extension of the mother, you're injuring or wasting or destroying part of yourself, which is a prohibition, correct? So, what do you do with this, right? So first of all, the question that was asked really only applies many people do things that are unhealthy, right? And there would never be a question, can you restrain people because they're eating potato chips too much, right? I mean, right? And they might harm their hearts, right? Now, it's wrong to overeat and to eat bad things, and it does increase the risk of a heart attack. That is true. Do we now police people if they eat too much? No, we don't, because it's a very gray area, and of course we're not, right? We're not, people do have to take responsibility for themselves. But the question here is different. The question is, number one, we are talking about a life. Questionable what the definition of that life is, but it's not just about, you know, potential risk. I mean, there are people, it's not a definite risk anyways. Even if it does increase the risk, it's not a definite risk, right? I know people that smoked heavily and lived till they were 93, all right? So there's no question that smoking shortens lives. Does it do with everyone? So it's question, you know, it's still a gray area a little bit, right? It's wrong and it's prohibited according to halacha. Now that we know the research on smoking is actually a prohibition, halachic prohibition. They haven't discovered it in Israel yet for some reason, but it is, right? At least where there's awareness of it, it's a very halachic question, whether one is permitted to smoke at all today. Different to yesteryear where they didn't know the risks and it was culturally acceptable. I mean, it's another discussion about taking risks in Jewish law, which is a very fascinating, maybe one day I'll do that too. It's a very fascinating discussion. But we obviously talk about a case where the damage, the potential, or the damage is pretty definite, and it's pretty much going to happen, right? The damage will happen. So I don't know precisely the answer, but going through what we just did, that even if we talk about a fetus being part of the mother, it's still part of the mother. Your body doesn't belong to you. Second of all, it is a life. Whether you say it's technically halachically a life which is separate to the mother or part of the mother, it's still another part of life. You are destroying life, which is maybe my own life, part of my own life, but it's still life. And it's definitely going to happen, or damage the life at least. It's definitely forbidden. It's definitely prohibited. So we do have precedent for restraining people that do that. For example, if God forbid someone was on a bridge and about to jump off, they'd be restrained. Right, we don't say, well, your body, your life, your do what you want. You want to jump? Go ahead. We'll even facilitate it for you, you know. Like, we don't do that, right? We obviously restrain them, put them in an ambulance, take them off to hospital, and keep them there as long as it takes for them to be safe. Also not always very, very effective, but I'm just saying. And we now put so much into awareness. But come push comes to shove, we will restrain people, not allow them to damage themselves. Right? Which makes it not so simple that the answer would be no. It might be the answer you do restrain. However, taking away people's freedoms is a big thing. That's the opposite part of this discussion. Theoretically, what in my mind, what my mind leans towards, and I don't know this decisively, this is the halachic answer, is that she probably should be restrained at some level, but done in a way which is given the most freedoms possible. The problem of system restraining that happens today is that restraining is done in a very negative way. It's like real restraining. Lots of other freedoms are taken away that don't need to be taken away. You have this with the prison system also, right? People can be in there for white-collar crime, for example, and they get very limited access to their family, very limited access with for emotional support, and so on and so forth, which is wrong. Which is probably why recidivism is so high. Yeah, but so I don't know what happened to the story. I think nothing happened. I think the case was dismissed for some reason. But nevertheless, it's an interesting question. It's a complicated question. I think there's good reason to say that maybe she should be restrained, but it would have to be in, from a halakhic perspective, but it would have to be in a way that you minimize the loss of freedom to its maximum, which would be difficult to do in the context of the current day system. So I don't know.
Rabbi, yes. Do you really deny your fetus has got a genetic issue, like a Down syndrome? You still can't do anything about it?
About abortion, you're asking? No, that's different. There are cases where you could. It all depends when and how far. It's another discussion. I don't want to get into it today. But no, there are cases in Jewish law where abortion is permitted. Generally speaking, Judaism is not pro-abortion. But it might depend also depending on the parent's situation, depending on... Like, I'll give you an example which is clear-cut where Jewish law wouldn't support it, for example, right? If the parents were nervous that they don't have enough money to bring up another child, they weren't planning to get pregnant, they did... That kind of thing. So we say, you know, you got to, Hashem gave you a fetus, you got to trust. Where it's going to affect, for example, if it's disability that I've discovered in utero is a complicated one because it's not so simple that you can abort halachically, but also might, you take into account also the situation of the parents and what effect it will have on them, and it's a complicated thing. Okay. The second issue that I want to bring up, just an interesting thing that I was thinking about, and then I happened to see it somewhere a few days ago, a book that was discussing it in a different case, which comes into a topic you once discussed in a different context, but nevertheless, I want to bring it up and just see what you say and have a bit of a, just highlight some points again from a halachic point of view, or a Torah point of view. Not so much halachic, I mean a philosophical sort of moral Torah morality point of view. So one case that recently got an incredible amount of attention was the mushroom case, right? I mean, because I don't know why I got so much attention, but I guess because it was... I'm talking about attention worldwide, like everyone. Yeah. So it was the Aaron Patterson case, who now referred to as the mushroom murderer or whatever. So she killed four people, essentially. No, sorry, she killed three people. Three. One of them, a brother-in-law, Pastor Ian Wilkinson, was spared. He had to have a liver transplant and he was in hospital for like 2 months or something, but... So I don't know if you know, a couple of days ago there was a pre-sentencing hearing, right? And there was a lot of victim statements that were read out and delivered and so on. And he got up and said, he asked his wife, who was one of the victims, as you know, Heather Wilkinson, and his brother and sister-in-law, Donald Gail Patterson. And he said an interesting thing. He got up and he delivered the following thing. He said that he described how profound the grief and loss was for him. He had a very good marriage and he was like felt very alone and so on. He called the crime callous and calculated. But he said he's come to a place, he's a religious guy, a Christian, and he wanted to publicly say that he forgives him. Right? And he publicly forgave Aaron Patterson. And it's an interesting question. I mean, she was clearly a murderer. I mean, according to the legal conviction. I mean, it's pretty circumstantially logical. But he publicly forgave her, and that's where he stopped, right? And he said that he no longer considered himself to be her victim. he said that now she was a victim of his kindness, whatever that means. Okay. So the question is, can you really do that? Can you forgive someone? What does it mean? Like, who's he forgiving? What's he forgiving her for? Right? For killing his wife? Well, he can't really forgive her for killing his wife. He can forgive her for his pain, maybe. Right? And what does forgiveness actually mean? Before we get there, and how he did it, it's a bit different to another very famous story which happened a few years ago in Australia, in 2020. You might remember this. The Abdullah family.
Yes.
Right? Which was very interesting, because actually, I mean, it sounded amazing, but actually not so simple. So you know the story, a drunk driver ran over their children and a cousin. And then 3 days later, the mother, I think, Layla Abdullah, mother of the children, she publicly declared that right now I can't hate him. I think in my heart to forgive him, right? And then they went on and they established this whole organization called I Forgive Day, which I think is somewhere in February. And the I Forgive is not F-O-R, but it's a number 4. Because they developed these 4 principles of forgiveness, which was acknowledge, accept, surrender, and voice your forgiveness, which obviously is an important thing. You voice it, you actually say that you forgive. Forgiveness is a very important thing, obviously, and an amazing thing. But then, what's interesting is the following. And this is something that... what's his name again? The Patterson one? Yeah, Wilkinson. Pastor Ian Wilkinson did not do. And he, the Abdullah one, went to visit the murderer in prison. He got a very long sentence, obviously. Even though it was manslaughter, but it was really reckless and negligent. And he said, he went to visit him and he embraced him and he forgave him. And then he said if it were up to him, he would let Davidson out of prison tomorrow. Right? The murderer, expressed deep remorse and spoke of his transformation in prison. And he saw the father, Danny Abdullah, as a spiritual mentor. So the question is that correct? Right? Now, note the difference between the two forgivenesses. Ian Wilkinson actually said that he forgives. He's a pastor, he's a religious person, he's forgiving. But it's his duty to seek justice. And therefore, he did not advocate for a reduced prison sentence. Now, putting aside the effectiveness of prison, that's a separate issue. But I mean, there are consequences to actions. There is justice. The concept of justice is indisputable, right? That's for sure a Jewish value, justice, right? So putting that aside, so let's for a moment assume that prison is an effective way of achieving justice or effective punishment. Let's just assume that for the moment, he did not advocate for the person not to have prison. He forgave him, but yet at the same time he said he's seeking justice. Whereas Abdullah, the father, did not. He said it was up to him. He's so forgiving of the person who doesn't want to see him suffer in jail for a long time. He would let him out tomorrow.
But he's saying that because of the society, he accepts that he should be in jail.
Who?
The father.
Did he say that?
Yes.
No, he accepted the legal application, but that wouldn't be his preference. You know, he voiced his preference that he should be freed from jail. He didn't campaign on that. He said there's a legal system, we've got to respect that. That's why I understood it at least, anyways. Okay, whether it's accurate or not, let's take that view for a second and contrast the two views.
So isn't it easier to
forgive somebody
if the intent was not to
kill
them?
If the intent was?
Not to kill them, like the car accident.
Correct.
Whereas the mushroom thing...
Correct. Okay. I mean, that is one explanation of the difference. But I'm not sure... I want to take it a bit deeper than that. I mean, not that... I don't know what was behind their minds, what they were thinking, but I think the difference is deeper than that. Because, you see, forgiveness is an incredibly important thing. Once in a 5-week series on forgiveness, I don't know if you remember, right? And I'm by no means an expert on Christianity, so I'm not vouching for the accuracy of what I'm about to say, but my understanding is, I understand a little bit how it works in Judaism, but I don't study... Christian theology only because I got, well, part of the reason is because I got so much more Judaism to study, so but in the Christian context, forgiveness is a huge thing, and it's kind of very unconditional. I think that's the ultimate Christian way of expressing forgiveness, right? Like, you just got to forgive, right? In Judaism, actually, it's also unconditional. One should work towards forgiveness, Also, you need to understand what forgiveness means, and we'll soon go there in a minute, just to summarize a little bit. But in Judaism, forgiveness must work with other values. We don't work in values in isolation. In Judaism, there are many values by which we live. Sometimes those values are contradictory, right? And we have to find a way. We spoke about this at the beginning of the war, if you remember, right? And sometimes you have to understand how to work with those contradictory values at the same time, because they're both important. So let's understand that. Forgiveness is a very strong value in Judaism, but so is justice. Now, it depends who seeks the justice, but justice in itself, meaning the concept there is justice in the world. Now, we do ask God not just to employ justice, we ask God in Rosh Hashanah to forgive us and actually not apply justice in the technical sense of the world. But justice exists, meaning that there are consequences to actions. We believe that. It's one of our principles of our faith, right? There are consequences to what we do. Now, there's also a third thing called tshuva, which we're about to enter the month of, and that God, and that sometimes it's forgotten to decide that. The difference between God and the court of Jewish law is that the court of Jewish law is mandated to go according to the facts. When they're not able to apply to convict someone, the person might still be guilty. The Talmud explains, then the justice application goes to God. And God has a greater vision. So he might, if the court wasn't able to punish him, God might still, but God can also see if the person really has repented and done tshuva, and therefore might forgive him, and that's fine. Right? So God can completely forgive, but there's a concept of justice. Right? Now, who should apply the justice? That's the interesting thing. So I'll tell you an interesting story. In Tanakh, a story of King David. Right? And why really, just this is a case for complete forgiveness. Not to hate a person who has done you wrong at all. Why? King David was traveling once, there's a whole story in Tanakh, and there was an individual called Shimi ben Gera, who was one of King David's detractors, and he wasn't such a good person. And he came up in front of everyone and he publicly cursed King David. In Jewish law, to rebel against the king, particularly to embarrass the king in public, to curse against the king, it's very strict. It deserves capital punishment. It's something that the king, without even proper due process, can actually convict that person and kill them. And people, King David's supporters, I'm summarizing the story. King David's supporter says, "Why don't you kill him?" And he says, "No." Why? Because he did curse me, he did embarrass me. But he said an unbelievable verse. We've talked about this theological dilemma many times. He said, "Hashem amar lo lekalel." God told him to curse me. What does that mean? Told him he should embarrass me.
Oh, he should?
Yeah. Why? What did he mean? Meant like this. Not that he did the right thing. He didn't say he did the right thing. But in Kabbalah and in Hasidic teachings especially, there's this incredible, almost theological contradiction. I'll just remind you, because we have talked about it before, that we believe everything is Hashgacha Pratit, everything that happens is for a reason. And everything that happens to me was meant to happen to me. At the same time, we have this thing that when it comes to moral issues, we have free choice. So you take responsibility, right? So I don't smash you in the face and then say, "Well, it happened, so it was supposed to happen." No, I did something wrong and I need to bear the responsibility. But deep mystical Hasidic philosophy actually puts the two things together and says that when something happens to you, it was meant to happen. Might be painful, might have a lot of questions. We have plenty of questions. We do not understand what God does. We've talked about this. That's what Emunah is all about. But if it happened to me, it was meant to happen to me. However, it doesn't mean that person was supposed to do it to me. That person has made a choice, and that person has to bear the responsibility for that choice. King David says, "I am not the one to apply justice because I have to take it as something that God wanted me to go through and experience, and therefore I can't apply the justice." But King David, before he died, he told King Solomon, his son, who was about to become the king, "Make sure you take care of that person." Because King David didn't want to do it because he felt that if he does it, he's mixing his own bias into it. And for him, he has to accept it. And applying justice would get in the way of him forgiving him and accepting it, because he has to get rid of the hate that he has to him, because it happened to him and it's God's thing. Who else did this? I've spoken about this many, many times. Joseph. right? When the brothers were petrified that Joseph would not forgive them, he forgave them. He said, and he said, because you didn't send me to Egypt. You made a bad choice. You threw me in the pit. You sold me as a slave. But actually, you didn't send me to Egypt. God did. Why did he? Because I can even see why. Because now I'm able to provide people with food. And the whole story how it plays out. Okay. And he believed that all the way. And he never had any hate in his heart for them. But there's an interesting part of Joseph's story, which I think I've never talked about. When they first came, he drove them crazy. He recognized them. They didn't recognize him. Why don't you just end the whole story and say, guys, I just want you to know, I'm Joseph, but don't worry, you're completely forgiven. You're okay. He didn't. He put them through. Why? You know why? Because Joseph was able, he was a great tzaddik, and he was on the level to do this and not be mixed up. Not everyone could do this, but he could. This is what the commentaries explain. He knew that they were in danger of God's retribution. He knew that they're in danger of God's punishment because they need justice. And he was worried for them. Therefore, he wanted them to suffer a little bit, not because of him. He had no animosity towards them. See how those two things work together? He had no animosity towards them. But he knew that what he could do is, he can make them a little bit scared, he can drive them a bit crazy, and he can put them through some pain, which was, in fact, it was helpful for them to achieve some atonement. Now, it's a very careful thing to say. It's a dangerous thing to say. Because you have to be on a level to be able to do that. Right? We cannot do that. We cannot say, you know, I'm going to drive my friend crazy who insulted me. Not because of me, I don't hate them at all, but they need retribution. No, that's God's problem. Leave it to God. It's fine. You just forgive them, right? But Yosef HaTzadik was able to do that. He knew his heart. He knew what he was thinking. I mean, King David could have done that too, but for some reason, King David didn't want to because he didn't want to mix himself into it. Okay, but Yosef did. Yosef put them through a tough time. And then he showered them with love. And he said, I have nothing against you. He did that because there is forgiveness, but there is also justice. When it comes to God, we try to do tshuva, and we hope that God just understands that we fail, and we're normal, and we're human beings, and He'll forgive us, and He can overrule His justice, which is what He does in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But there is the concept, right? So it's a difficult thing. Now, also what's important to understand is, what is forgiveness? What does that mean? Forgiveness is a very, very difficult thing. Because having said there is justice, but forgiveness is critical. The Talmud says, and I've talked about this many times, about the person in the Talmud who said, someone asked him, how did you live so long? There's a whole discussion in the Talmud about people who had a very long life, and they asked him, like, what did you do to merit such a long life, right? And people said different things, and we learned some very great values from that. One of them said, I never, ever went to bed hating someone. I always forgave them before I went to sleep. And that's why there's a prayer in the Siddur, in the bedtime Shema. It's called a prayer of forgiveness, right? Now, the perpetrator, as we learn just in the laws of Yom Kippur, actually should be seeking forgiveness for their good, right? If they wanna be free of any justice, they need to seek forgiveness. Especially when you come to Yom Kippur and we ask God to forgive us and to overlook the things we've done. If it's about things we've done to upset God, He'll forgive us. But if it's things that we've done to upset other people, we really need to make up with them and we need to go seek forgiveness. But actually, that's a separate issue. Because I need to say the prayer of forgiveness before I go to sleep, because forgiveness is not only good for the perpetrator, forgiveness is good for the person who it happened to let go of hate. To let go of hate. And I think I told you before, the Lubavitcher Rebbe has a long talk on forgiveness, and he says that there's actually three kinds of forgiveness. There's actually three kinds of forgiveness. The very basic level of forgiveness, which we have to aspire to do more than that actually, is to just not wish bad for the person. Right? Now, as I said before, it's not such an easy thing either, by the way. Often in the back of our minds, you know, I don't wish him any bad, but, you know, like, when you hear the guy's in trouble, that's like revenge, yes. Yeah. So you don't want one thing. You know, and it's sometimes hard, like sometimes someone has really hurt you, and you hear that he's in a bit of trouble, you say, oh, well, you know, what goes around comes around, you know, all kind of stuff, right? So you don't want to do that, right? So that's first. However, that's not the forgiveness that we should aspire to. We should aspire to a better forgiveness than that. That's the level two. That's the middle level. The middle level is to let go of any hate. Say, look, I really can't be that person's best friend anymore. It just doesn't work. It doesn't gel anymore. The relationship will be maybe permanently damaged, cordial and respectful, but not the same. but I have no hate. I'm letting go of hate. That's really what it's about. And that's why these two stories, both stories of forgiveness, are really beautiful. That's what it's about, really. It's about letting go of hate. Right? It's letting go of hate, and that's an important thing. Because that's forgiveness for me. I can say I don't hate. You see, in both these stories, people are giving forgiveness really on the behalf of, you know, that's what I always say. You can't forgive for the Holocaust because it's not for us to forgive, right? Because it's for the 6 million victims of the Holocaust to forgive. But there is a concept of not walking around with constant hate, because hate's not good for you. Hate's not good for the person, it's not good for your spiritual, it's not good for your growth, it's not good for anything, right? So letting go of hate is a really good thing. And that's what really forgiveness is about. Real forgiveness is about letting go of hate. I don't hate anymore. I'm prepared to accept, either using the philosophical idea that what happened to me was painful, but it was necessary for me, I'll become a stronger person through it, whatever the case is. Your choice is your choice, you need to deal with it between you and God. I can let go of hate. There's a third level of forgiveness where you restore the, that's what Yosef HaTzadik did, Joseph did that, where you restored the relationship that was before. That you say, I forgive so much that I'm prepared to enter that relationship and restore it to the close relationship that it was there before. That's very difficult. Not everyone can do that. Joseph HaTzadik did that, and people can aspire to that. But that's not the expected level of forgiveness. So putting it all together, I think the forgiveness in these two stories are both amazing. And it's people saying that I'm not going to walk around with hate and anger and vengeance. Because we do find that, I mean, there is justice, but sometimes we find that the victims are walking around their whole life like, I want that person to get justice, but it's not for justice, it's for, I'll feel better when I see them suffer kind of thing, right? On the one hand. So therefore, this is really good. This is really amazing. It's an amazing thing to do, and it's certainly something to learn from. But I would say that in the earlier story, in the Abdallah story, the idea is, therefore, I would like you to leave jail tomorrow. That's questionable, because, first of all, what impact will that have on other people? I mean, it's nice for a person to sit 3 days in jail and say, look, I've learned my lesson. Have they? You don't know. I mean, you need to clarify that, right? I'm not sure jail is good for anyone, but nevertheless, there is a concept of justice, and there's also a concept of responsibility to the whole community, and responsibility to provide incentives or deterrence for violence and for things that hurt other people not to happen. Is jail the best option? I don't think so, but nevertheless, it's got to be something. And people do need to have accountability, and they have to be held responsible, and consequences do have actions. So I'm not sure that forgiveness always includes wishing the other person doesn't have any justice. I don't think it's not our job to inflict justice, it's not our job to administer justice, but it's also not our job necessarily, when appropriate, at least when other people are involved, to say that justice shouldn't happen. We don't know. I don't know that. That's a hard question. But the forgiveness part, which is more about me letting go of hate, that is certainly an ideal. And even in circumstances like this, there's a lot to learn from, and people can come to that level and say, I let go. I think the more realistic one is the one that, from the mushroom case, where he says, I really sincerely do give forgiveness, but I'm not going to interfere with the justice process. I mean, it could be that the second case was like that, but I think that's probably how it should play out, I imagine. I remind again, all the things we talked about before, take a fly if you want, and next week we're starting a 3-week series, learning from the amazing symbols.